Today's Teisho will be on case 37 in the Hikigan Roku, in the Blue Rock Collection. Case 37 is entitled Banzan's Three Worlds, No Dharma. Engo's introduction. The spirit which moves like lightning, you fail to follow. When the bolt descends from the blue, you have no time to cover your ears. The scarlet banner flutters over the master's head. The two-edged sword is being brandished behind the student's neck. Unless your eyes are sharp and your hands move quickly, how can you cope with the situation? One will lower his head and ponder, following the delusive ways of thought. Don't you know that countless skulls are haunted by ghosts? I want to ask you, without falling into the delusive way of thinking and without halting irresolutely, how can you respond to the teacher's words? See the following. Main subject, Banzan said to his disciples, in the three worlds there is no dharma. Where could you find the mind? Secho's verse. Three worlds, no dharma. Where could you find the mind? White clouds crown the heavens. The streams draw music from the heart. Tunes and harmonies which none can understand. The night's rain has brought the autumn waters deep. I want to thank everybody for coming here to practice Zen this morning. I hope you had a good sit. Some of you came at 7 and have been sitting here for 4 hours now, and some of you came at 9:30 and sat for an hour, and now we have the Teisho. I noticed that some of you didn't get up during the break period, but just sat through until the Teisho. That was very impressive. I'm very glad you were able to sit so deeply. You know, what we're doing is, if you've been reading books on Zen, if you know something about Zen, what we're doing makes some sense. But if you aren't very familiar with Zen, this may all seem very strange. This is a little bit like coming into your living room and sitting down in front of the TV, but not turning on the TV, and just staring at the screen, you know. Or it's a little bit like going to a lecture, and everybody comes into the lecture room and sits down, and then the person who's supposed to speak comes up to the podium and doesn't say anything for an hour. You know? So it's actually rather strange because, you know, we're not really thinking. You know, it's not really about thinking. The people in the modern world, are quite used to information. You know, quite used to information. And we enjoy getting a lot of information. I myself read the newspapers online. And I'm quite convinced that the internet is addictive. Because I myself am somewhat addicted to it. So I will get up and sit, and then often if I have time, either at my home or in my office in the morning, I will go online and I will read like the Huffington Post and some of the other online news aggregators or newspapers. And then, you know, I'll work in the morning and I'll come back to my office, and before I start working again, I'll think, gee, I, I wonder what's going on in the news. I want, you know, since I last looked at the internet, I wonder what new news has emerged. And I'll actually go back hungrily looking for more information. I think many people have, I think I have developed sort of like an internet addiction. And I think many people have like an information craving. It's just like any other kind of craving. You know, so it's like I want novelty. I want something new, and I want some more information. I remember as a kid, I don't watch TV much anymore, but I remember as a kid grazing through the television, you know. So I'd turn on the tube and I'd look at this channel and there was nothing on. There was something on, but it wasn't interesting. And then I'd look at this channel and there was something on, but it wasn't interesting. And I would go through all the channels searching for novelty, you know. I had like a hunger for something that would catch my attention. And it's like, no, not this. No, not this. No, not this, you know. And I recognize in my internet behavior a lot of the same kind of craving that I had when I used to watch TV. There's like a kind of a hunger for novelty or information. And our whole society has, I think, sort of like this addiction, you know. All the time, as we're growing up, we get information all the time, and we want fresh information, not stale information. And the life of, like, the intellectual life, the life of the mind, is really often based on getting plenty of new information. You might go to a lecture, or maybe you're in school and you go to a lecture, and a lecture might be boring. You know, you might think that guy's just not very interesting, you know. But you might go to a lecture and the professor is fascinating, you know, and presents new things and a new light, and you find yourself pleasantly excited and maybe a little bit disoriented. And it's, this information is coming at you, and it's stimulating. And it's, you feel that something really new is happening, you know. It's like something really new is happening. And when it's over, you can feel like you've had a good meal, or you can go away sort of unsatisfied. But that feeling of stimulation is quite powerful. And this happens to people all the time, you know. This is part of the modern world. This hunger for information and this being stimulated by lots of inputs, you know. And in fact, you know, we've created a whole society, a whole civilization around the flow of information. Really, no society on earth has ever delivered so much information to people before. We have enormous libraries. And every year, we publish many more books than any person could read. Even in any particular field, more articles and books are published than anyone could read. It's gotten so bad that libraries don't know what to do. Because, you know, I have friends of mine in my field who have published like 5 books, 6 books. And there are maybe 50 people in my department. They haven't all done 5 books, but if you do the math, let's say the average professor in my department does 3 books. That would be 150 books, right? And of course, professors are going out and professors are coming in, and so, you know, it's like a book factory. Often, if you check some of these books online, you'll see they aren't checked out at the library. So a lot of these, it's like the book factory is just churning out books, right? And you know, you couldn't really keep up even in your own field if you wanted to. And this is like unprecedented, right? And knowledge is getting produced faster and faster in greater and greater quantities. Like some fields, like physics, have just gone to the internet because production of knowledge is moving so quickly now that even print journals slow things up. Now, you know, we're going to get to a point where it's like gridlock, right? Information gridlock. There's too much for anyone to know, and basically there's too much for anyone to store, you know. And that day is coming, you know, because the amount of information in the world just keeps growing and growing. And we get more and more finicky about the information we take in, you know. It's like if you're very, very hungry, just having a bowl of beans is delicious. But if you have 100 different bowls in front of you, you can be very picky, you know. So people are like connoisseurs of information, and they have like information addiction, and the information is getting produced more and more. And we like a satisfying performance, you know. If we go to a lecture, we like a lecture that's satisfying, that satisfies our hunger for information, and also that is witty and clever and keeps us turning around unexpected corners. You know, that's the best kind of a lecture. You can't see it coming, you know. And this is the world we live in, even if we're not students, you know. Information is so much a part of our lives, and it creates this sense that something is about to happen, you know. Something important is about to happen. I'm not sure that something ever does. You know, that's the interesting thing. It's like you're constantly going through like a door, and you're very excited as you go through the door, but then you get into the room and it's kind of boring, and you look for the next door. And then you think, oh, there's the door. And you go through the door and you think, oh, this is going to be really exciting, and you go into another room and it's just another room. And this goes on and on. I think this is a little bit how we actually live. You know, so we live in this extraordinarily rich, information-rich society, and the information is being produced at an ever faster pace, and we're all sort of like information junkies. You know, we're all sort of hungry for information. And that makes something like Zen all the stranger. Because, as I say, this is like coming to a lecture, but there's no lecture. It's like everybody walks into the room, the professor comes up to the podium, and then they just turn off the lights and you sit there for an hour. And Zazen has that quality, you know. It has that quality. It's very strange. You know, if you haven't been here before and you came at 9:30, this might all seem rather odd. You know, we're just sitting here. And if you don't know anything about Zen, you might be baffled. You might think, well, what do you do on the cushion? You know. And when you sit down on the cushion, though, it turns out a lot is going on, you know. If you sit down on the cushion and you watch your breath, you notice that right under the top level of your mind, the part of your mind that reasons and plans, there's like a river flowing. And it's like this river of pieces of thoughts and memories and all kinds of stuff like that, images. This is like... there's just a level of the mind which is very rational and present and seems consistent and so on. But that's just a very, very thin layer of the mind. And then right under that layer, there's like this layer which is like a raging river of pieces of thoughts and words and ideas, images, memories, and it's just raging. And it's almost like madness because there's no order to it. It's just this stuff going by. And this is part of your mind. It's not the part most people pay attention to. And then if you continue to watch your breath and you practice for a while, you know, your mind goes deeper. There's another level of the mind which is much more still and more empty. And the thoughts, there's still thoughts in the distance, so to speak. But they're not right at the center of your consciousness, and the thoughts are coming and going, and it's as though your mind is dwelling immovable in this calm, empty place. Now, if you keep meditating, you can get to a kind of emptiness which is so profound that there's absolutely nothing anywhere. You might be residually aware of your hearing if your eyes are closed, and you might feel a little cold, maybe, or a little warm, or you might feel some sensation in your body. But when you're really in a deep state of this emptiness, which we call mushin, or shunyata, you can be in it so deeply that everything seems to disappear. And this is like zero inputs, you know, zero information. It's a state that many people rarely enter. But it's an astonishing state. You know, it's an amazing experience. If you haven't done much meditation, what I'm saying might sound like science fiction or a lie. But if you practice meditation, sooner or later you're going to discover there's like a place in your mind, so to speak, which is blank and empty. It's like a chalkboard. An old-fashioned slate board that's totally empty. There's nothing on it, you know. Or it's like walking into a room and opening a door. It's like opening a door and walking into a dark, empty room, you know. Or even it's like walking to the edge of the ocean at night and you can't tell the difference between the air and the ocean and the land and the ocean. It's just this great vastness. And this is really quite important in Buddhism in general, and in Zen in particular. Because all of this information that we take in has an effect on us. It has a kind of an effect, you know. Very profound, it can be very profound or it can be very shallow, you know. But people tend to underestimate its importance. I was reading something the other day that people who read the papers a lot have a lot of anxiety. It turns out that they were studying people who the reading habits of different segments of the population, and they found that people with multiple degrees or advanced degrees or college-educated people and so on tend to read the paper more than anyone else in the society, and they actually are more anxious about events than anyone else, which makes sense, right? So if you don't read the paper and you don't know enough to be anxious, that's great, you know. People who read the paper a lot, you know, they said, are very anxious, but they actually have a distorted view of events, because they said newspapers themselves distort events. They report on events that are they report on events that are they single out possible disasters, crises. That's how they catch your eye. You know, they single out information that's going to be catchy or sticky, and they try to find things that are going to be frightening or ominous. And so you don't get very many stories in the newspaper that say union reaches agreement with management, everybody happy, right? You know, those tend not to appear. So they said actually people who read the papers have a somewhat false view, because it's like the world's about to fall apart every moment, and the newspapers encourage this. It turns out that people who are information hungry have like a distorted image of the world. I'm not saying you shouldn't read the paper, but this information has an effect on us. It has an effect, and we might think it doesn't, but it's quite profound. I was reading another article that was saying that they were talking about how people, it was like a study by some psychologists, and they were talking about how information, even if you know it's false, can change your opinion if you hear it enough. Isn't that interesting? And the political parties know this. They know that if you keep repeating a lie, even if people think it's a lie, over time it will influence their behavior. They'll act as though it were the truth. And this is something also that advertisers know, that if you keep saying it, eventually it has an impact on people, even if they know they're being manipulated. So the information we take in has a deep effect, even if we don't think so. So, if you watch a movie where there's a lot of violence, you might think, well, it's just a movie. But if you are a meditator, you might notice how often during the next day you are like rehearsing scenes of violence in your mind or responding to events around you in a threatened way, as though you're threatened, you know. This is like, you could think about all of this as like karma, you know. Basically, all this information we take in has an effect on us, and it leaves a result. It leaves like traces. And even if it's as trivial as a television show or something we read on the internet, it leaves traces. And of course, more profound life events can leave very deep traces. So, you know, you can experience things in childhood that that change your responses to things very profoundly forever. So, for example, my mother's uncle went into the war in World War I, and this was the beginning of modern mechanized warfare. And my uncle had his jaw blown off in France. And at that time, they didn't have modern prosthetic surgery. They didn't have plastics, for example. They hadn't been invented yet. And so they made a metal prosthetic jaw for my uncle and rebuilt the skin over this like metal frame. And when my uncle came back from World War I and went back to his home, he was in constant pain from this crazy jaw that they built. And eventually he blew his brains out in the kitchen of his house, which was near where my mom lived. And my mother, when she was just a little girl, went in and found her uncle's remains all over the floor of the kitchen. And this was like, my mother remembered this with incredibly powerful emotions, like the day before she died, you know. So these events happen to everybody. You know, these kinds of things, traffic accidents, illnesses, you know. And these also are deeply implanted in our consciousness, you know. So, being able to access this this blankness is really quite liberating, quite wonderful. Because if you go, when you first encounter it, it might seem frightening. It might be deeply disturbing. But if you stay there for a while, when the bell rings and you get up from your meditation, you might actually feel very beautiful, like very purified or clean. I have to say that I've been doing this for 30-some years, for more than 30 years. And, you know, I have many wonderful sits. Not all of them are really super sits. But this morning I had a really deep sit in deep mushin, and when I got off the cushion, I felt very purified, very clean, like every atom of my body had been scrubbed clean. That doesn't always happen, but when it does, it's fantastic, you know. And And, you know, this is from going into deep mushin, and basically it's like undoing or erasing or getting free from all of these karmic traces that we build up moment by moment, day by day, year by year. And when you get off the cushion and you walk outside, everything can have this quality of newness or freshness. You know, it's really quite beautiful. And and the other thing that's quite odd is that, you know, sitting on a cushion in a room like this might seem absolutely stupid, right? In the sense that we're not discussing Heidegger, you know, we're not discussing the future of the economy. We're just sitting mutely on these cushions in silence. And so for a beginner, you know, this could seem excruciatingly boring, you know, like excruciating. I have known people who come in on a beginner's night and try meditation and leave actually angry. There was a guy who was actually one of my students. He's an attorney now. His name was John, and he's a wonderful guy. He actually loves a bonsai trees. You know, he makes bonsais, and he gave me a bonsai that he made himself. So he's a very nice guy, and he was an excellent student. But he heard about meditation, and he came to meditate, and he gave it a try once, and it left a very bad taste in his mouth. And he was almost angry because he said, "This is so stupid," you know. Naturally, I hit him. I said, "Well, different strokes for different folks, you know." And we're still friends, and I'm always happy to see him. It's not everybody's cup of tea, but he was actually offended by what he thought was like the vacuousness of this experience, you know. This is like, if I may say so, this is like a classic Western view, right? It's just people in the West have never, you know, it's interesting. You know, the Greek word for chaos, Greek word chaos means emptiness. Isn't that interesting? It doesn't mean disorder, it means emptiness. So the early Greeks knew about emptiness, but they didn't follow up on it. And after that, it's like emptiness has had no, has always been thought of as like bad. We have a saying, something is always better than nothing. In Zen, we think, no, it's the other way around, nothing, you know. But in the West, we say, "Oh, something's always better than nothing." Right? Emptiness is bad, you know, being left with nothing. So this young man, who is a nice young man, and is still my friend, you know, just he had a real negative experience with this, and he actually sort of ridiculed it, you know, in a pleasant way. You know, the truth is, it's deeply transformative. And liberating. And when you sit down on the cushion and you enter deep mushin and you come out of deep mushin, you become aware of your surroundings, you suddenly realize that it's not an information poor environment at all. That the world, the ordinary world, is an information rich environment. It's just we don't notice it. And this is especially true. Like at Sesshin, you know, we do sitting in a building which is more open to the outside than this, you know, so you can hear birds singing. In the summer, you can hear insects, beautiful, like tidal waves of insect noises, you know. And you can hear the sound of cars going by, wind, rain. You can hear the sound of other people breathing in the room, and other sounds as well. And it's remarkable, you know, when you go into deep mushin and you come out of deep mushin, you realize that there's just like this, the information is everywhere around you, and it's profound, deep, and complex. And, you know, if you're on your way to work and you hear birds, you might think, oh, birds. You know, I hear birds. If you're sitting on your cushion and you hear birds, you begin to notice extraordinary subtleties. Scientists who study bird calls have come up with all kinds of information, you know, astonishing information. Recently, some scientists have been studying dolphins and the kinds of sounds they emit and the complexity of the sounds. And there was a recent article that said that dolphins are probably quite as intelligent as human beings. You know, a chimp is supposed to be as intelligent as a three-year-old human being. That's interesting, isn't it? So many experts say a chimpanzee is as smart as a human baby, a human infant, three-year-old. And they said dolphins are considerably smarter than that. And so the scientist, the woman who does this dolphin research, said in her view, dolphins should be recognized under law, she said, as non-human people. She said they're extraordinarily intelligent, very complex communication. Well, you know, she discovered that by spending 30 years studying dolphin noises, which of course many people just think of as squeaks, right? It's a trivial. Squeaks, burps, you know. But actually, profound communication. Now, she doesn't do Zazen, but she paid attention in a different kind of way to those sounds, you know? In other words, she didn't start with what she already knew. She started with shunyata. Okay, let's just assume nothing and study, right? And this kind of openness to the world is quite difficult. This is why, you know, like scientists work very hard to cultivate this openness, right? You know, we keep experiencing what we expect to experience so often because we can't get free from our assumptions. You know, so this is how this is a big problem for us as people, because, you know, people who have like neurotic problems, in other words, most human beings or all human beings, you know, often can't get free from these because they just keep bringing to every moment the same old assumptions, fears and conditioned reflexes, you know. And so, you know, when you go into deep mushin, there's a chance, especially if you stay there for a while, of experiencing the moment in a new way, a really new and fresh way. And scientists work one way to do that. They work very hard to do that. And they invent gadgets and other things. But we Zen people work very hard in a different way. We enter mushin. And then when we come out, sometimes we find the most extraordinary things. You know, things that actually don't make any sense to the discriminating mind. And a lot of koan training, a lot of Zen training is refining consciousness to the point where you can notice things that escape ordinary consciousness. You know, ordinary awareness is too dependent on assumptions, language, and so on. Being in mushin really allows us to make pretty amazing discoveries, and it also sets us free, helps us to break free from many of our psychological barriers. Sounds good, doesn't it? I was doing some work the other day, and I came across an old book that I haven't read in 20 years. It was called The Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind. I think it's called The Origins of Consciousness and the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind. And it's by a guy named Julian Jaynes, who died a few years ago. And this book came out in the 1970s, and it was so revolutionary that very few people paid much attention to it. But it got a lot of press, you know, especially in psychology circles. But Mr. Janes was like an assistant professor of psychology. And he was doing some work with some archaeologists. And he noticed that in ancient times you had a lot of images of human beings, but you never had faces on the images. And he looked at hundreds and hundreds of drawings from like cave paintings, early Greece, the Mediterranean, China, Africa, and he said, none of these pictures of humans have faces. It's like they just had like a circle. They didn't even have a smiley face. It was like the smiley face without the smile. And he said, that's odd, isn't it? And nobody else paid any attention to this, but maybe he was able to have a fresh perspective. And he started reading a lot of literature, like Greek, the Odyssey and the Iliad, and early poetry from many civilizations. And he said, actually, early human beings didn't care much about identity. Isn't that interesting? He said, early human beings didn't think of themselves as individual people. And he began to do a lot of research on how the brain functions. And he came up with a theory that around maybe 40,000 years ago, the human brain started operating in a different way, and people began to see themselves as people, and that it took a long time for this to stick. And this is what he calls the origins of consciousness and the breakdown of the bicameral mind. The mind is, the brain is divided into two hemispheres. And in a lot of animals, the hemispheres are identical. They're like mirror images of each other. But in some creatures, like humans and dolphins, as a matter of fact, the two hemispheres aren't symmetrical. There's hemispheric asymmetry. And so Jane said that at some point, the two hemispheres in our brain stopped being symmetrical, and there was like a split. And he said, basically, our sense of self came out of this moment. And that's his argument. And I came across this book, which I hadn't read in 30 years. And I thought, this is so interesting, because, we tend to live our lives in this personal self, personal self. And it becomes so all-consuming, And this is interesting to me right now, especially because of what's happening to one of my friends at work. One of my friends at work is involved in like the politics of Rutgers. He is like an administrator. And he is about 10 years younger than I am. And he came here to Rutgers about 10 years after I did. And we're good friends. And I am an administrator too. I run a program, a freshman English program, which has made me the target of many students dislike me. It's a big program, but I'm not really like high up on the totem pole, to put it that way. And my friend, who's younger than I am, came to Rutgers 10 years after I did, and he was an incredibly talented administrator. And he was just like a genius. When he would organize events, he would always do something that was so eye-opening and exciting. And he really like revolutionized our department, and the president put him in charge of redesigning the campus on College Avenue. I don't know if you're aware of that, but they're going to close it off to traffic, and they're going to build some incredibly ugly new buildings. They had a committee of architects, and they had the models in the art building, and I went over, and it was just like, oh my God, these are awful. The one they're going to build looks just like a giant can. It'll be like a giant white can. So all the students can say, on the banks of the old Raritan, I took classes inside of a can. Not over yet. So anyway, my friend was responsible for that. And he organized, he brought the architects in, and they brought some very interesting architects in. One that I like, he's from New Mexico, his name is Antoine Prédoc. Monsieur Prédoc is a very interesting architect, and does a lot of work in the Southwest, and he had a beautiful design that they didn't like. So he's very interested in connecting with nature and so on. So anyway, my friend chaired this committee, and he was like going step up, step up, step up, 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 up the ladder, right? And everybody was going, oh, do you know so-and-so? Oh, he's brilliant, brilliant, you know. And I like him myself, so I'm happy to say he is brilliant. Well, anyway, this is, you know, in the world of human beings, there's always politics, right? And on his way up, he made enemies, right? And eventually, some of them were jealous. Sometimes he stepped on people to get where he was going, you know, very ambitious person. And so at some point, instead of going up the ladder, he got stopped. And then, you know, basically people who didn't like him pushed him off the ladder. And you could say, did he deserve it? Did he not deserve it? You know, this happens. You know, a year ago, Mr. Obama was elected with a resounding majority. You know, 3 years from now, he might be the, as we say in English, he might be the bum, right? You know, this happens to people often for reasons they cannot control. And my friend is just like melting down. You know, he's a good friend of mine, and he's really like totally melting down. And he's very angry, and he's making his situation worse and worse. He feels like everybody has injured him and done him an injustice. And he's so angry. He feels so abused and offended, and his pride is hurt, and his dreams are shattered. It's very painful to watch. It's like watching a car accident. And I was reading this book, and I thought, you know, we all live too much in that self, you know. We all live too much in that little self. Naturally, when we're in that little self, we think of ourselves as the center of the world, right? You know, it's like, oh my God, you know, I was at the top of my game, and now I'm at the bottom. You know, everybody's kicked me in the pants, and it's like the whole world is falling apart, you know. When I was in high school, I pushed myself too hard, and I always wanted A's all the time. And if I didn't get an A, I would go home, and it was like a tragedy. And I would, you know, I didn't literally flagellate myself, but I would really sort of punish myself. I would say, you know, I was sort of saying, you're a bad boy, you know. And it was like the whole world was falling apart around me, you know. And now, you know, 40 years later, 35 years later, I can say, well, it was just a paper, you know. I know people who, in their graduate courses. You know, they didn't. One person I know got a B plus in a graduate course. And this person was just melting down. It was like the end. I mean, I honestly was afraid this person would hurt herself. And I told her, look, you know, nobody cares what the grades you get in your graduate courses, you know. All you have to do is pass your exam, write your dissertation, you know. The dissertation might be junk, you know. You might have gotten straight A's on all your courses. The dissertation might be junk, you know, so it won't help you that you got straight A's and vice versa. Nobody's going to go, well, by the way, you know, you've written five books. What kind of grades did you get in graduate school? You know, nobody's going to care about that. You know, and of course, I have known many, you know, to be an academic is a difficult life in some ways. It's a great life, right, because you have a lifetime job. But it's a difficult life in other ways, too. I was reading the other day that the average academic book sells 200 copies. Right? So you spend 7 or 8 years writing this book. It's 350 pages long. It was 800 manuscript pages. You tore your hair out. You spent Saturdays writing it. It comes out. It's reviewed. It goes to the library. And I've known people who, you know, have been very depressed, you know, negative review of the book or this sort of thing, you know, can lead to like major like meltdown. And it's easy if it's not you, it's easy to say, oh, come on, it's just a book, you know. But what we're really saying in a way is, oh, come on, it's just your life, right? You know, it's just your life. And that then it becomes really frightening, right? You say, my God, this is my life. You know, I was on the way to the top, and now I'll never be vice president, right, of Rutgers. I wrote my fourth book. This is hypothetical since I haven't written four books, but you could say I wrote my fourth book, and you know, I was poised for greatness, and now this bum has written this terrible review of my work, and this is my life, and it's ruined. And those moments are very painful. On the way over here, I was reading about a guy who tried to commit suicide. It was on some NPR station early this morning, and it might have been the Radio Lab. If you ever listen to that program, Radio Lab. And there's a guy named Jad Abumrad who was narrating, and he was talking about this guy who got very depressed because life wasn't working out the way he wanted, and he jumped off, I think, like the bridge in San Francisco, I think, the Golden Gate. And he described it. Obviously, he didn't die. You know, the guy who jumped, and he said, you know, he things weren't going well at his workplace. Everything seemed to be caving in on him. And he said he drove right by his job, he parked his car, he put money in the meter. I thought that's good. Okay, great. You know, put money in the meter, walked to the middle of the bridge and jumped off the bridge. And walking up the bridge, he said he had this tremendous sense of liberation and relief. And he climbed over the edge, and he said, just as he let go, it hit him, this is a terrible mistake. Right? And then he dropped, they said, down into the water. And the amazing thing was, they said, several thousand people have jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge, and only about 20 have survived. He survived, right? In fact, he was almost uninjured. He had some severe bruises and things, but he was like in a cannonball position when he hit the water, and there's some police around there. They saw him, and a boat came out and picked him up. And I just thought, you know, it was so interesting that he thought like this is a mistake, you know. But it's that comes from spending too much time in the small self. You know, it's too much time in the small self. My friend who's melting down You know, is just like he's just he can't you know he can't get we he can't get over himself. He said, "Get over yourself," you know, and because he's been, we tend to fall back to, that's like our default position a lot of the time, especially if we've been done an injury, or if something has hurt or shaken our confidence, right? You know, often when something shakes our confidence or doesn't go the way we want it, we sort of go back to a default position, which is like the position of a little kid whose world is entirely himself or herself, you know. And this is the situation of my friend who's just hurting so much, and the situation of this guy who jumped off the bridge, you know. But you know, I mean, one of the things you can realize if you do Zazen is that that's not the whole of yourself. You know, that little self is just a part of who you are. And that you're really a part, you're really inseparable from all this life around you, you know. That your life is bigger than your personal life. It really is. You know, your life is, the Kurt is a kind of fiction, you know. I too worry about Kurt. I too feel sorry for Kurt, you know. But Kurt is kind of a fictional character. And he was invented by my parents, and by me, by my teachers, by my civilization, and so on. But he's not the whole, he's really not real in a certain sense. He's a fictional character. And he's not the whole story, right? And doing Zazen, you know, you could get on the cushion, you can enter deep mushin, and every once in a while, we get this deep feeling of, like, not only is everything around us communicating with us in a very profound way, but we're part of all of this. And that feeling, I mean, the more Zazen you do, the more deeply connected you can feel to the world around you. It's like you begin to realize that your life is not a Kurt. That's just a little part of it. Your life is everything around you, and it's arising out of emptiness and going back into emptiness in this way that's very difficult to understand, but it's incredibly beautiful, and it's like infinite. You know, it's like this life reaching out, going on and on. And so, you know, Zazen is really quite wonderful because it allows us to live this bigger life, which is not, which is, I think, totally real. I think Kurt is a fictional character, but I think this world that we live in, this universe, is profoundly alive, you know. I think that's real, you know. And Kurt's real, too, in a certain sense. You know, I'm not saying I won't pick up my check next week, you know. but it's not that important. And, you know, when you look at your own life from the standpoint of your Kurt identity, it can seem like a massive struggle and a very and like a tragedy. It's like, this is a tragedy. And I have to admit that sometimes I fall into that mindset too. I do. And what a tragedy. But you know, if you can be in deep mushin and you can feel connected to things, you know, it's like you realize this is a comedy. Right? It's a comedy. Right? It's a slapstick comedy, you know. You know, it is. It's a comedy. And the difference between tragedy and comedy is this. Tragedy is about a person who's basically a good guy and the universe steps on him, basically. That's a tragedy, right? But in a comedy, it always works out okay. In a comedy, all the people are sort of like half-wits, right? They don't see the whole picture. And they stumble into happiness, right? You know? That's a comedy, right? So tragedy is like a good guy getting clobbered by a bad universe. And a comedy is like, we don't know what we're doing half the time, but what do you know? You know, we stumble into happiness. And that's so the universe is kind of like a comedy if you have the right mindset. You know, I remember there was an interview with some Tibetan teacher in Tricycle magazine. And they interviewed him and they said, listen, you know, we've got global warming, you know, they say the temperature of the earth may heat up to a point where, you know, the greenhouse effect kicks in and all life as we know it will be, you know, boiled in steamed to death and et cetera, et cetera. And they said, what do you think about this? And he said, and he actually showed his picture and he was smiling. He said, well, nothing lasts forever, you know. And he wasn't being snide, or he was just saying, look, he said, sooner or later, everything has to end. You know, and it's got to end somehow, right? And this might be how it ends here. I thought that was a wonderful answer, right? It's like you do your best, but, you know, basically, if you live in the little self, in the Kurt self, you're probably going to be quite unhappy. But if you live in the bigger self, you know, you can respond like that teacher, you know, like that Tibetan guy. And it's not fault. It's not wishful thinking. You know, we know, I remember reading that even brilliant people can be very self-deluding. You know, there was an interview with Stephen Hawking, you know, the great physicist. And at some point in the interview, Stephen Hawking started talking about the fact that in like 50 million years, or it might be more, I don't really know how many, but he said it was a huge span of time. It's like in 40 million years when the sun expands, you know, the sun is going to eventually expand and consume all the planets in the solar system. And Hawking said, in 50 million years when the sun expands, by then we'll have space technology and we'll be able to get off the planet, evacuate the planet. And I thought, my God, that's crazy. It's not the evacuating. Look, humans have been around for about 100,000 years. In 50 million years, you know, evolution doesn't stop, you know. You know, we will have trunks by then and wings and things like that. We'll be in the, oh, you know, who knows? But we won't be human anymore, you know. We won't. The planet might indeed be dead by then. It's very unlikely that in 50 million years, you know, we're going to care about some of these issues, you know. But that's the human way, right? He's thinking in the little Stephen Hawking way, you know. But you know, if we can get out of ourselves and participate in the life of the universe, you know, it becomes a very exciting place, you know. Even without space travel, it becomes really beautiful, really amazing. And it's like life becomes this big adventure and it becomes this comedy. It's like life is a comedy. You know, if you read koans, so often, you know, people hit each other in the head, they slap each other's faces, they laugh insanely, they put shoes on their head. And it's like the Three Stooges, you know. And you might think, what is this all about, you know? And if you see Zen pictures, you often see these guys, you know, they have insane looks on their face. And you might, if you're down and you're feeling depressed, you might think, well, what have they got to smile about? You know, they're dressed in rags, you know. But it's like they understand this is like the great universal comedy of existence, you know. And it's going to turn out okay. It's going to turn out, if your perspective is big enough, it's going to be okay, you know. There's something really amazing about all this. It might not turn out the way you personally want it, and that can make people furious, right, and depressed and angry. Me too. But when I sit on the cushion and I get outside of my Kurt consciousness, you know, I realize, you know, really, you know, that's not so important, you know. I mean, it's not so important. You know, the day will come when, like, you know, someday, if humans live long enough, the day is going to come when somebody will go, Shakespeare who? Who's Shakespeare? No, I don't know. Do you know? No, never heard of the guy. I mean, that day is going to come. You know, the cities turn into dust, you know. Greatest minds that ever lived, you know, their works just blow away in the wind, you know. It great art, you know, sooner or later, you know, like the Mona Lisa is just going to turn to dust, you know. You can only preserve it so long. Everything falls apart. Everything goes away. Nothing continues. You know, isn't that wonderful? I think it could be very liberating. You know? Banzan said to his students, in the three worlds, there is no Dharma. Where can you find the mind? So there's this other consciousness, this Mu Xin, right? Which has no content and no form, but it brings everything to life and it liberates us from our karmic attachments and fears, and it sets us free from these chains in which we have wrapped ourselves. Secho's verse, three worlds, no Dharma, where could you find the mind? White clouds crown the heavens, the streams draw music from the harp, tunes and harmonies which none can understand. The night's rain has brought the autumn waters deep. This is a bigger mind. This is living outside the small self. So, I love this line. Don't you know that countless skulls are haunted by ghosts? You know, when we read the paper and we get upset and we get angry, or when we worry because somebody didn't say hello to us in the hallway, you know, we're like skulls haunted by ghosts, you know. It's better just to be an empty skull. You know, I'll stop, but, you know, in Zen art, you often see these wonderful drawings of skeletons playing, right? Skeletons. It's like, you see this in Mexico, too, in Mexican culture. You know, the Mexicans have this thing called Day of the Dead, and they do these incredible papier-mâché statues of skeletons dancing a tango, you know, skeletons eating dinner, you know, and they're all so joyous, right? You know, the skeletons are really happy. There's a common one in Mexico is a father and mother skeleton wheeling a baby carriage down the street, and in the carriage is a little baby skeleton. See, and Zen has this too. It has dancing skeletons. They're playing music, they're playing the shakuhachi, they're doing calligraphy. And you might think, how morbid, right? How morbid. But what it's saying is, if you don't live in your small self, if you give that up, and you become like a living skeleton, right? It's like being already dead is a great thing, because now nothing can hurt you, and you're just at play in the universe, you know. And in a way, you know, when we do zazen on the cushion, we're like practicing being dead. But the strange thing is, when your little self dies, you know, everything comes to life. It's like, imagine if you didn't have to worry about keeping yourself alive. You know, how beautiful life can be. Well, it can be like that. So anyway, not much information this morning, but beautiful, not much... conventional information this morning. No news, no bulletins, no reports on the stock market, you know, but really beautiful encounter with the big universe, right? So please keep practicing.